Thank you.
W Service Transportation.
Thank you. Wow. And really, thank you for your patience. All right. So, I never know how to structure the presentations from one particular focus because the audiences at the public library are mixed. Obviously, we're all different ages, we're all different backgrounds, and the only commonality that we all share is the desire to improve our financial condition. Beyond that, who knows? So what I've done is I've structured the presentation a bit in two ways. One is ways of looking at garnering retirement income when you're retired, and then I identified particular strategies and what we can do on our way to retirement. Interestingly enough, two might be very similar. So, what's the secret to financial success? Good.
A budget.
I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm.
So that?
You'll be set, you know, once it's time to retire.
So you'll be set when you retire. And all of this leads to one thing for me, cash flow. Having a positive cash flow. Having more income coming in than income that's going out. No, income never goes out, does it? Well, unless you somewhere along the line lose it on the way home. But more income coming in than expenses going out. So let's talk about the backwards. We're going to start from retirement, then we're going to work backwards. And I started with the keys to a dream retirement. We want to know where the keys are because the keys that we had a few years ago are not the same ones that we're going to need today. Here you go. And we can take a bunch and you can leave them in the back too, please. Thank you. All right. So I wrote that over the past few years, over lifetimes, over decades, financial planners use a rule of thumb for retirement. And the magic number used to be 70% of your current expenses should cover your retirement expenses.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Sure. In the past, there used to be a rule of thumb. In fact, some people still use it today. And 70% of your pre-retirement expenses are going to be sufficient when you retire. So whatever you're spending now, 70% of it is enough, assuming what comes in and what goes out are even out. Now, the fact of it is that I can't really live on 70% of what I'm living now because I don't anticipate doing all that much different in retirement years. And the irony is that during retirement years, you also have more free time and you also have more costs. So our incomes may stay fixed, but our costs will continue to rise. So that is an assumption is not going to work. And then the other assumption that we use is you take a straight number for inflation. You know, the average rate of inflation is 3%. Let's use that. And you know what? Let's assume a current rate of return. And, you know, let's make believe that 2008 never happened. And let's use, you know, the average rate of return for the stock market for the past 70 years, which is 9%. Let's plug that in because you'll really do well over the long term. Well, those don't work. Because you can't make decisions in your life based on long-term rates of return and based on long-term assumptions. You constantly have to reevaluate what your assumptions are to make sure that they're appropriate for the current environment or the current state that you live in. So the reality is that the accuracy of the numbers that we project for retirement is really a function of way too many variables for us to ensure that they're going to be accurate. So what I'm saying to you is that there really is no magic number. The magic number is not 5% rate of return. It's not 7% rate of return. It's not I need $1 million at retirement. The fact of it is that the situation is going to be personal to you. your lifestyle habits, your spending, your financial outlook, your personal philosophy. Those are the things that you have a bit more control over. You're not going to have control over the outside environment. So rates of return, we'll talk about that a little bit. So when we talk about retirement, we talk about withdrawal. What's the magic number that you can withdraw? Used to be a steady number where if you withdraw up to 4% of your retirement portfolio, then you should do fine. Is that going to hold in the future? I don't know. It all depends how the investor and how you behaved and how your portfolio behaved in 2008. If you had a portfolio that was diversified between stocks and bonds fully invested, and in November, December, you're down 25%, and you say, gosh, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to sell everything. And in January, you're sitting in cash. Chances are that 4% is meaningless because you now have 25% less than what you started with. So what I'm saying is that there is no guarantee. What you would like to look at is look at your income and look at your expenses. And take away the rates of return that you are evaluating and throw it into the garbage. Why? Because we're always going to use a rate of return that's going to be based on our current psychology. And I included here that for the six-year period ending 1999, I'm going back a while, but the bond index had a 5.9% rate of return, and the S&P had a 23% rate of return. And I remember new clients, meeting with new clients in my office, and one of the questions I ask is, well, what kind of a return do you expect from your portfolio? Because I want to not only assess, addition, what someone's risk tolerance is, but what their expectations are. And a client said, well, you know, 17%, 18% on the average. I said, thank you, I can't do that. But of course it was happening year to year in 1998, 1999, so on. So the S&P had a 23% rate of return. Over the past 10 years, I've seen financial planning journals that have given retirement assumptions at 12%. What was that based on? It's always looking backward. And we as human beings are going to make our future decision based on our personal experiences, and the way the economy mirrors us. The most conservative clients, people become more conservative after they've suffered a severe setback financially. And of course, the more positive the returns on their portfolio, the more risk that they're willing to take. So your risk tolerance is constantly changing with your success. My mother was in a car accident a long, long time ago. She was severely injured. She was hospitalized for a few months. She was fortunate to heal. Never drove again. Foolish? Yes. Is it understandable? Yes. So the way our experiences, the way that we handle those experiences are also going to have an impact on our future financial success. So, I gave you a lot of blah, blah, blah. Are we getting anywhere yet? I mean, she hasn't told me how I'm going to retire rich, and she hasn't told me how I'm going to stay above water during retirement. So, what it really comes down to is many things. Cash flow, preservations of your capital, and how much of your income is coming from your portfolio. The more you have diversified sources of income, the better off you're going to be in maintaining your cash flow throughout your retirement. Because the more income you take out of your portfolio, obviously it's going to either impact the principal if rates change, rate of return changes, your needs change. So what we need to do is we need to create some kind of a financial plan. We need plans that have a strategy so that you don't have to worry about your investments, but you can be more focused on your life. And the only way you can do that is to create some kind of a financial planning process. The assumptions, well, during retirement, expenses are not going to be constant. Healthcare, taxes, inflation are certainly going to increase. We're in we're in a deflationary environment at the moment, but that's not going to be a long-term trend. Why? Because trends are not forever. And you really have to make sure that at this very, very low time of, at this period of very low interest rates, that you're not invested in a manner that's going to hurt you when interest rates change. And recognize that your expenses are not going to change. So I'm going to skip a little bit, and I'm going to move on to what strategies are during retirement. Well, what you're going to do is do a very basic financial planning function. It's called, you're going to identify your sources of income. Let's see. I receive interest from this particular bond. I receive my dividend from this portfolio, mutual funds, individual stocks, whatever that might be. What other sources of income do I have? Do I have a pension? Do I have Social Security? Do I have other revenue streams, perhaps rental income, or what are the other sources? And identify what those sources are. Now, what you do is at the end of the year, you have a portfolio, and you have a portfolio where you've identified what your overall allocation is. And of course, in a portfolio, you'll have stocks, and you'll have bonds, and you'll have cash. You might have some gold funds. You might be diversified. What you need to do is at the end of the year, you need to do the same reevaluation and reevaluate what percent you should have in each allocation. This is called portfolio rebalancing. And my objective is not to sit here and tell you that you need to have X amount in stocks or X amount in bonds, because there is no magic number for all of us collectively. But what you do need to know is that once you've identified what that target rate is for you, you need to revisit it. And if you identify that you need to have, 35% allocated to a particular stock funds, bond funds, whatever, at the end of the year, as it rises, sell that off to meet that. What happens here is, what do you accomplish by doing this, actually, instead of me telling you? What do you accomplish when you rebalance a portfolio? Well, you accomplish a few things. One is you keep your greed in check. Okay, and keeping your greed in check is a way of managing your risk. And of course, it helps you to keep your long-term focus so that you're not constantly jumping. You're not jumping in and out of asset classes, but you're saying, this was my goal. It's over. Let's move on to another area that might be more undervalued or an area that has pulled back. Now, on the other hand, let's say yes.
Is this something we do on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis?
Oh, goodness, no, don't do it monthly. I apologize. I'm being disrespectful. The reason you shouldn't do it on a monthly basis, in spite of the fact that markets are so ridiculously volatile and they will continue to do so, your investments, and I'm going to assume stock and bond type funds and investments. If you're invested in the stock and bond market and you own mutual funds, you're going to have a much longer time horizon than 2 years from now or 3 years from now, because the money that you're going to use 2 to 3 years from now is where?
CDs.
Money markets, CDs, in your checking account because you need it. And I know 0% interest rate everywhere, but that's okay. All right, because your objective is not to make money. Your objective is to have that money safe. But the money that you have invested for a longer term, you really need to look at it two ways. One, I have a portfolio that I'm expecting to do X, and that's going to be my core portfolio, and I'm not going to touch that. My retirement fund, something 10 years from now. On the flip side, I recognize that, wow, gold has been really moving. I should have been participating in gold. Maybe it's not too late. Maybe do I need to have allocation to gold because I'm expecting inflation. I'm expecting a lot of market turmoil. gold's not a bad investment. I'm not recommending you buy gold. So what you do is you have particular tactical allocations to that portfolio based on the economic changes. You should maintain your core portfolio and revisit it quarterly. Look at it. If you're off 1%, continue. If you have allocated 35 and now you have 36, it's okay. It's when we get to 35 to 40. About 5% movement really makes a huge difference.
So if you're with an investment firm, it's always good to take a look at your portfolio on a quarterly basis.
Absolutely.
If you're going to try to actually do it yourself and follow it, if that is your goal. Because right now, depending on someone to look at your portfolio, not knowing their reputation, so to speak, and fearful of that, you would actually start your journey to learning more about it to find out if exactly after the end of that third quarter you're going to have to make some changes.
And
but if you're with a good company like T. Rowe Price, that you have targeted investments for the long term, then you're okay. You shouldn't be worrying so much. Let it ride because they're a good company, but at the same time I should be educating myself. And also to see if I want to make changes, knowing that I'm capable of making those changes and switching from T. Rowe, and then I could just handle it myself. Does that make sense?
Yes and no. The part that makes complete sense is that, yes, you must become educated about your investments, and you should have a trusting relationship with the person, not the entity. Because entities are anonymous. You know, entities do stupid things. People do stupid things. Your relationship is going to be with your person. If you have a relationship with a person at an entity that you trust, you should still look at your portfolio quarterly. Whether it's T. Rowe Price or Vanguard or Merrill Lynch or ABC Investment Advisors or, you know, the best financial planning firm on the block, .LLC.
So I shouldn't make the assumption that just because state.
Never assume anything.
I've lost a lot in the past. Right now, T. Rowe Price is very good. But I don't know if it's good working in such a large volume of employees. Is it looking out for my investments? I'm not sure, but everything I read, everything I hear, T. Rowe Price is up there. So I'm like saying, okay, I'm okay, but you know, don't forget it. Educate yourself, because even though they're doing this, I'm not sure they're doing to their fullest. Because I don't have the relationship with T. Rowe Price. So I don't know afterwards when I feel more comfortable, should I leave the state and go?
I think I have a suggestion for you. I think you may have to reevaluate T. Rowe Price as an investment company that has different mutual funds, and you pick the mutual fund that is commensurate with your goals. I don't know if T. Rowe Price provides you with advice to make purchasing decisions. So unless they're providing with purchasing decisions, what you're really looking at is an investment, not the advice. And you need to separate the two.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's like Vanguard. I trust Vanguard because John Bogle is, you know, king. Well, he's not, but you know what I mean. But they're not going to be telling me which fund to buy. So there's going to be two separate things. It's not only whether the investment that you own meets your needs, but what's the combination of investments to meet your needs. And it's those combination of investments that I'm talking about when I say to review your portfolio quarterly. Look, don't close your eyes. You may have the best advisor in the world, and you know what? Just that day they missed their train, they fell asleep, and you know they didn't realize that the world was falling apart. All right. You're welcome. Pardon us. We engaged a little bit of a tete-a-tete here, but I hope it was beneficial. So we talked about rebalancing. We talked, of course, using your available cash to fund your income at retirement. And now let's say you incur a shortage. Where should your money come from? Don't look. So you incur a shortage in retirement. Where should your money come from? Money market, fixed income,
babysitting.
Yeah, how do you supplement your income? Babysitting is good. So I hear they also pay off the book sometimes. The place that you want to gather your shortage from are certainly your most liquid investments. So first you're going to go to your money markets. And then what you want to do is you want to look at your CDs or your fixed income. And this may sound like counterproductive. Why aren't I selling my stock funds because I need cash? Well, chances are if you have a shortage, the most of the volatility is going to be coming from your stock funds. And you want to leave that as a core for the long term, so that that continue either writing itself or to continue to grow or to continue to do nothing. You want to use the income and the resource from your fixed income. And that's just a way of ensuring that your money will continue to grow. Right? Now, how do we get there? Well, we get there by financial planning. And what's important to note is that financial planning is not a product. You don't go somewhere and you buy a financial plan and then walk away and then go home and then buy some investments. Yes, sir?
I read that in the last 10 years...
Nice to see you again.
In the last 10 years, I read that the bond funds actually did better than the stock funds. So when we are talking about long term, it may not be that the stock funds will do better than the bond. It may be the other way around. The bond funds will do better than the stock funds or not.
Absolutely. Do not know. I cannot tell you what they will do in the past 10 years. We do know what they've done over the past 70, 80, and 90 years. And what the concern is with many investors and investment professionals alike is whether we are entering various decades of either prosperity or whether we're entering a decade where there's going to be ongoing economic deterioration and essentially, you know, continued market deterioration. I don't know the answer to that. What I do know, though, is that when you are reviewing your portfolio, and I say take your income from your fixed income first, cash, fixed income, and allow your longer-term positions to ride, what you also have to consider is that the allocation to your portfolio is not fixed for life. In 10 years ago, an aggressive portfolio, you know, I look back at the presentation. I've had the good fortune of doing many, many presentations here in the past 10 years. And I look back and I see that my allocations are not the same. Because then our most aggressive portfolios, we talked, yeah, you know, look at 90% equities. Today, if I look at our most aggressive portfolios from our clients, maximum is 50% allocated to equities. So it's not to say that it's an all or nothing game. I recognize that one asset class can outperform another over a certain period of time. But if you're betting on the long-term overall growth of this economy and this country, it's going to be through overall production and growth. And you're going to recognize that growth in stock ownership. Is stock ownership or mutual funds that invest in stock? Is that going to happen in the next 5 years guaranteed? I don't know. I mean, we could do many conversations on that, but I don't know. So, yes, you're absolutely right. Yes?
Is that 50% maximum for working people?
The 50% is a general statement, and whether or not you're retired is not as much the issue as opposed to where will your sources of income come from. And if your sources of income is based entirely on your portfolio, then you're going to have a very, very conservative portfolio. And that very conservative portfolio might have 15%, might have 20%, might have 6% in stock funds, because that seems to be the scary allocation as of late. So it's a function of your sources of income and the kind of time frame and the risk that you're going to take, or the risk that you are willing to take that you can tolerate. All right? We're back to that old financial planning thing, remember? Yes?
Yeah, quick question regarding your note here. Yeah. highest performance first.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you go with the highest performance first? Is it because that would offer you more, you know, at some point with stuff along the way?
I'm sorry, repeat the last portion. Why the highest performers? Okay. The reason that the highest performers are the ones that you would want to sell first, and this is assuming that you're invested in mutual funds, okay, and because I have to assume diversification. Sometimes stocks go down and stay there for a good reason. Sometimes it's just time to sell them. But if you're diversified, then your portfolio will have some positions that obviously are increasing in value and some that are going down. Over the short term, small caps have had a huge run. So perhaps if you're going to rebalance that portfolio or you need to take money from your equity portfolio, then I would take my highest winners first and take, as one would say, some money off the table. Take some profit. And there's nothing wrong with taking a profit from an area that has had substantial gains. On the other side, if your other investments are maybe investments that you bought in 2008, which are still down, perhaps you may want to continue holding them because the investment was right. It's just the timing was wrong. So just because an investment has lost money doesn't make it a bad investment. But it never hurts to take a profit, take advantage of the money that you've gained. All right, sure. So,
Or if you've made money, you better put a stop. You better put some kind of hold so that it does not decline again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's going to be most important, not only in, well, it's a hard one to do in mutual funds, which is where the rebalancing comes in. But when you own individual stocks, it's very important to take that in consideration. Absolutely. If you buy a stock at 10, it goes up to 12, and it goes up to 14, you know what? Look back and put in a stop at 11 or 12 or 8 or 9, depending where you are. And that way what you're really doing is you're protecting your position from further downsides. And that's definitely an investment conversation. So thank you. It's absolutely correct. So if you want to take control of your financial life, well, we know what you want to do is retire. So you can't retire without taking into consideration time and money. I want to retire when I am, I don't know, I want to retire when I'm 70 years old, 65 years old, and I need $75,000 of after-tax income. Great. I now have time and I have dollars. And I'm going to assume that inflation will be about, I don't know, 4%, 5% maybe over the longer term. Right now, CPI is very, very low. I wouldn't worry about it. But so your goals, retirement, the only way you can begin by creating that process is to identify your goals and to put together not only your income and your expenses, but your assets and your liabilities. And today, I think the biggest issue that people have with retirement, well, we know it. It's the same thing we all have. It's debt. Because we are now changing our philosophy toward debt. I teach class at Baruch. I teach fundamentals of financial planning for financial professionals who want to be CFPs. And I remember talking that about credit cards and consumer laws. And, well, yes, you know, the use of credit card fuels the economy. And it's a fact. And it's a stated economic assumption that is a reality, but in the same sense, that boom also becomes a bust. If you can fill in all the blanks. So what would be the short-term goals to get to your long-term retirement goals? Debt reduction. Emergency fund. Who here knows what an emergency fund is? Okay. And I heard 6 months of what you make. What if you make $3 million? But you only spend $1.5 million. And I don't know anyone who does that anyway. So it's 6 months of your expenses, of your fixed and variable expenses. So we're going to talk about retirement. There's no value in saving for retirement if you don't have the foundation. You can't build that house, that retirement house, without your financial planning foundation today. And that's going to be saving for an emergency fund. Have 3 to 6 months. In fact, the more precarious your job situation is, the longer your longer time frame your emergency fund should cover. I have a client who's a commercial real estate broker. He hasn't had a deal in almost 2 years. His emergency fund, well, his emergency fund was a year. We're now dipping into assets. So there's a different way of identifying that. So your emergency fund should cover 3 to 6 months. Could be as high as 1 to 2 years. Your will, another very basic aspect. Your wills, your beneficiaries, all of these are important things to take your financial house in order. Will they affect your retirement directly? It's not going to affect your retirement income as much as it's going to affect the peace of mind that occurs within your family, knowing that you have your affairs in order and you also knowing that you've taken the proper steps to achieve that. I don't really know what to do. I don't know where to start. How do I increase my confidence about my finances? Again, a lot of people talk about what they do, but they don't know how to get started. I think this is a great vehicle. This is a really good start for getting a basics on the finances, because what you really need to do is think about your goals. It's not enough to say, I want to retire. We know you need a time frame, you know you need a dollar amount, but then you also have to do some evaluation and say, am I being realistic? And what is it that I need to change now to achieve that? And that comes to two things. So there's two kind of facts we're going to talk about. One is the cold, hard facts, as I just said. But then the other one is what we call the mushy part, the qualitative. And that's your attitude about your lifestyle, your attitude about your expectation for your retirement, how you want to live your life, what are the things that are important to you. My sister and I have the same parents, and financially you'd never know it. My sister was born saying, Erica, do you know what I need? And she always needs something. And whether it's the power, her kids are all grown up, whether it's the blue-purple Power Rangers you can't find anywhere, and there I am hunting every Toys R Us in the city in those days. There were a few. And I look back and I think, gosh, we squandered so much because we really weren't thinking. And we were taught to not address the idea, I can't have it for my child. So when I talk about philosophy, it's time to reevaluate our attitude toward money and how we spend our money, so that we can figure out how to save. What's some rules of thumb to consider? Well, the amount that you should be paying over on your credit cards, if you're thinking, I have these numbers so you don't have to write them down, but if you take your net income, your income after taxes, and take 20% of that, so if your net income is, you know, I'm going to make it easy because I'm not big on numbers today, but if the income is 100, your after-tax income, your net is 20. That means the amount that goes to your credit cards a year should be less than 20. If you're making 50 after taxes, the most that you should be paying to your credit cards are $10,000 a year or about $800 a month. You can figure out that math and prorate it for your situation. In New York, monthly housing costs pretty much are a meaningless number because the amount that you should be spending for your home, your apartment, rent, maintenance, mortgage, less than 28% of your gross income, that's your income before taxes. I know young people who are renting apartments and spending 45% of their income because New York is a different animal. Does that make it financially astute? No. New York is a different animal, but so what? It still is not. It's going to be a hindrance to building that wealth. Mortgage lenders, Who here has refinanced a mortgage lately? Wow. Mortgage rates are at historical lows, 4 3/8 as of yesterday. If your total debt payments are less than 36% of your gross income, you're in good financial shape. There's not that many people who are in that position. Because if there were a lot more people in that position, then chances are there'd be a lot more people spending money. But that's not exactly the case today. And savings should be 5 to 10% of your gross income. In part, this is covered by 401ks, which is considered a contribution to your saving, but also added to additional savings on the side.
Your mortgage should be 36% of your gross income.
It should not be. It's the maximum that you should be allocating. And that's your overall debt. So that's your mortgage, your credit cards, your consumer debt, your overall debt.
Your overall
everything.
36.
Consumer, collateralized, non, no recourse, everything. Anything having to do with your debt should be less than 36% of your gross income. And that's the payments on your debt. So that's the payment. So, of course, the lower the interest rate, the lower your payments are going to be. But what really happens is the lower the interest rate, the more people borrow. So we're still thinking in the old ways. So does that make sense? These are just basic rules of thumb that have to do with basic financial planning. Why? Because all of that relates to retirement. And then when you take into consideration inflation, taxes, and your spending patterns, well, then that's where you come up with a budget. And I know you hate to use that word, but I have to talk about successful money management because remember I said that the key to successful retirement is your cash flow? Think of it this way. You had a huge portfolio and your income was X. And now you had a portfolio that's half of what it was worth and your income is still X. Feels okay, doesn't it? Feels a lot better than having a half a portfolio and half an income. So if you have consistent income during retirement, then that is a way that you can continue building and holding on to what you have. So let's talk about successful money management. How to save for it. Question is, where does my money go? I had a friend many years ago, still a friend, and she couldn't figure out how to afford sending her son to preschool. And preschool was about $5,000 here in the city. She just didn't have the money. Who do I borrow from? Maybe my in-laws, my parents. So I knew that once a week, she and her husband go out for what they called quality adult time, you know. I still don't have quality adult time. And they'd go to a movie, and they'd go to the diner. Nothing fancy. And they'd grab a babysitter for a few hours. So a movie's $10 a head, right? That's easy. It's $20 for the movie. You go to the diner, no matter what, you know it's going to be $30 for two people, no matter what you're going to have. So now we're up to $50. And they're going to be out of the house a few hours, and it's fair to say that babysitter is going to cost them $50 for those 4 hours that they're out of the house. What are we up to?
100.
How many weeks in a year? 52. There is $5,200. Can this family send their kid to preschool? Yes, they can. But they have to give something up. And sometimes the only way you're going to achieve something is by giving something up. So by writing down where your money goes, you can see what you might be willing to trade off to gain something. And gaining that something really is future security or meeting a future goal. Sometimes there's nothing to trade off. Sometimes there is no excess. Sometimes there is no movie and diner once a week for $100. That's when we really have to work much harder because If there's no excess, then we have to identify how we can either get additional income or identify other strategies, such as reducing healthcare costs by looking at different carriers, reviewing your tax situation, evaluating your sources of income, and minimizing the taxes. So how do we do the money management? Well, you add up all your sources of income, you add all your expenses. If it's plus, you're good. If it's negative, well, I could have told you that. But what if you have this huge excess? You don't have anything to show for it. Or what if you find that you're spending more than you make? How am I going to figure it out? So this is where we tell clients, get the black book and start writing down what you spend. And you don't have to do every second, but recognize, you know, that the Sunday paper is $6 and a magazine is $5 and a bagel and coffee is $3. And it's so easy to spend $15 a day in New York and not have anything other than just consumption. So from that perspective, start writing down how you spend and where you spend. Coffee, taxi, newspaper, stamps, snacks, etc. And do that for a month. And then after you've done that for a month, write them down in categories. And a clean way of looking at it is this. Fixed expenses, variable. My fixed expenses I have zero control over. My mortgage is my mortgage. My rent is my rent. My maintenance is my maintenance. My phone bill is my phone bill. I still have to pay it. And your variable expenses are those which have a little bit more control over, even though they're necessary. Variable expense doesn't mean going to Tiffany's. That's a discretionary expense. A variable expense is an expense that you need, like food. You can either shop at the supermarket or you can shop at, I don't know, some fancy store I can't think of, food store. So now you know where my mind is. I don't shop there either. But you have a choice of where you're going to be shopping. And then what you do is you write that down. Money coming in, money going out. Money coming in is always easy to identify. And once you've categorized your expenses, well, then you multiply them by 12 and you get an annual figure, and now you can see the difference. And don't forget your taxes. And don't forget the amount that you're contributing to your retirement plan. And don't forget the amount that you're contributing to your benefits for health care and insurance. All of these are expenses which people often forget about. And then once you've done this, then you go, how can I increase my income? All right, well, let's see. My mortgage is at 6.5. I can refinance for a lot less. How can I refinance? You know what? I had a substantial amount of income. It was taxable. How can I change this? I'm shopping. Do I really need this? I think of my sister when I say that. So when you establish your priorities and make your trade-off, then you have something to gain. Look at Barnes & Noble. I was there a couple of weeks ago to buy a gift, and I was amazed at how many people sit there, read the books, drink the coffees, and then don't buy the books. Years ago, people would buy the books out of guilt. Today, it's like, no, I'm going to leave it here. So there's, go to library. Do you know that at the library upstairs, they have every single bestseller, brand new, in lovely vinyl that you can take out for free and return? Sorry. So nonetheless, I share this because it's a reevaluating how we spend our money and what our goals are. So brown bag, take a bus, grab a library card. And this is not new news. This is not recession story. This is not, gee, let's spend less because we're in a recession or, you know, we really need to worry about our money because of our future. This is something smart that you can do anyway. But part of that is reevaluating how you look at your expenses. So what's the priority for successful? Bingo, cash flow, yes, cash flow, that's it. That's it, as long as you can maintain a positive cash flow to live the life that you want to live, you're okay. That's it, end of story. All our challenges are in getting there. So for all those problems, debt reduction is your first step. If you have credit card debt, regardless at what rate. Credit card debt is the first step. You know, a good strategy for getting rid of your credit card debt? Anyone have a plan? Yes, ma'am. And what do you do with the money that you spent on the first one, that you used to pay off the first one?
I move it to the next one.
What's your name?
Teresa.
Teresa, you're brilliant. Come, you can do this. That's it. That's exactly it. Start with the highest rate, sometimes highest balance, but I go for the highest rate. Pay as much as you can. When you're done paying off that card, whatever money that's been allocated to that card now goes to the next one, and so on and so forth. And the reason you shouldn't be doing them all across the board is because why?
You can't afford it.
Well, you may not afford it as well, but you get more value by allocating to the highest interest rate because you're taking down that debt, which would take forever otherwise. But psychologically, it's also rewarding to know that you've accomplished, I've taken care of one, and now I'm going to start with the other. Yes, ma'am. Ah, great question. That answer seems to change with every decade. It's wise to maintain your oldest credit card for as long, forever. So my first card was since 1982. I still have it, regardless, because it establishes your credit. On the other side, there's not much value in having 7, 8 credit cards all open to you, because that serves to reduce your overall credit. Because a lender will say, oh my goodness, she has 7 credit cards with, you know, $6,000 limit on each. That's $42,000 of available credit, so I'm going to lend you X less 42. Or some, obviously, not that direct number. All right. Yes, ma'am.
What about, for instance, student loans?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What's happened with the economy, but paying that off all at once, that's difficult. Are you supposed to pay it all at once? Is that better?
Is it better to pay off your student loan than
figure out how to do it and just pay off the entire student loan at once or not? Does that work as a credit in your favor?
Paying off your student loan is a credit in your favor. Having a student loan is a good debt. It's a good debt because you've actually, you've achieved something with that debt. You didn't go out and buy, you know, you didn't go to Tiffany's, all right. So having said that, any money for your college education is a good debt. Any debt is a debt you don't want to have. So the question is should I pay this off or should I begin investing, for example? Oops, because you were going there.
Right. That's my issue at this time where I'm almost there. I could just pay it off completely if
pay it
I
off.
Wanted to and just forget
pay it off.
About it.
Absolutely pay it off. Because I cannot tell you what will be in 5 years, but I can tell you one thing, your debt will still be there unless you pay it off. You can make investments, you can buy things. Your investments, I don't know where they'll be in 5 years. They might be higher. But I know your debt's going to be there. And your debt is going to be continued albatross. Get rid of it. And current rates are at zero. Year-to-date market performance is minus. Bonds are getting to minus because rates are inching up. Pay off your debt. You'll send me a thank me card. You'll send me a thank you card, not send you a thank me card. I'm a big, big advocate of paying off debt because it follows you unless you do something. Investments sometimes don't follow you in spite of how hard you want it to work in your favor, but your debt is constant. So debt reduction is always a priority. Now, on the other hand, if you have a mortgage, if you can afford it, surely add to reducing your mortgage. But the thing is right now we're talking about increasing our cash flow. And if we're retired and we want to maximize our cash flow, taking down your mortgage at retirement is not going to be in your best interest. As generally, of course, there are situations where the numbers work. Our goal is to increase our cash flow, so refinance to a lower rate. Debt reduction, identify your financial situation, have a handle of where what your goals are and what your current financial condition is. And the only way you're going to understand the impact of your financial decisions other than immediately experiencing them is doing the cash flow statement and identifying your assets and your liabilities. If it doesn't exist on paper, it doesn't have the same weight. And one of the reasons that financial planning is so successful in helping people reach their goals is because we put it down on paper. And by identifying your assets, your liabilities, and your cash flow on paper, and then looking at your investments on paper, you've already taken a first step. And of course, all the other aspects. I certainly don't want to ignore the taxation and the retirement and the estate planning. Cash flow, budget, savings and investments. We can talk a little bit about how to invest and how to save, but I'm not quite sure that this is going to be the venue for it. But I'm happy to talk about investments and different type of investments. Yes, ma'am.
Tips of inflation protected security. Mm-hmm. Some writers are in favor and others aren't. In the columns, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm confused because now we have a low interest rate economy. Is there any point in buying that now, or do you, if you wait until interest rates start going up, is that smart? I don't understand it.
Well, you invest. Tips are inflation protected treasuries, and. What happens with the TIP is that it adjusts accordingly, and the rate adjusts accordingly with inflation. Best time to buy TIPs is, well, when? I guess before inflation? I mean, there's a negative way of looking at it, taking the opposing aspect. But you want to see what TIPs are paying and what treasuries are paying. And sometimes if there's not that much value in buying them, you may want to wait. However, the recommendation is going to be based on who believes what will happen. If you anticipate that inflation is going to be our future enemy, then yes, TIPS are a very good place to be. If you anticipate that deflation is going to be our future enemy, then I'd imagine bonds are going to be the best place to be. And if you think that deflation and taxes are a worse enemy, then municipal bonds are an even better way to be. So I think the way to look at it is identify in your mind, make an educated decision as to what you think will happen. And based on that, you can adjust your portfolio accordingly, which is not to say that some don't hedge both sides. So there are portfolios that naturally made up of stocks and bonds and some TIPS and some on the more aggressive side and some more looking for the deflationary aspect by investing in bonds.
It doesn't look like they want to raise interest rates anytime soon, even though people are afraid. I think this is going to go on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the maximum to put in TIPS again?
It's a function of your objective in your portfolio. If you're risk-averse and conservative, then you would certainly add a small portion to TIPS because what they do is they serve as a hedge in case inflation does occur. Over the long term, we look at stocks and the growth associated with them to outpace inflation. So if you're an aggressive investor, then the stock portion of your portfolio would be the one that would override that allocation to TIPS.
So it's very personal.
You have to, because what it is that not only do you have to decide, but it's based on what you believe the economy will do. And nobody knows. And from 1 month to the next, you know, the economy grows a little bit and suddenly everything is great. And then in April and in May, everything was awful. So when I say everything awful, am I just identifying market volatility? Life is not awful. It's just the markets are volatile. Yes. Yes. A long-short fund is a mutual fund that strives to make money by buying and also shorting, meaning selling, borrowing securities. So what you want to do is you want to make money when it goes up, and you want to make money when it goes down. That's why I say we're going to be long a position, I own it, and I'm going to be short a position. So it's a barred short security. But the reason that it's popular now, why is it popular? Because nobody's making money anywhere. And whenever no one is making money, what do we look at? We look at alternative investments. And I'm not putting that as a negative. I think it's very, very smart. It's actually becoming more popular over, I'd say over the past year and a half, to look at alternative investments as an asset class. And alternative investments, to me, are almost the opposite of an index fund, because they're very actively managed. And, for example, one mutual fund might be looking at arbitrage situations where one company is buying another and there might be an inequality in the value between their stocks and their bonds. Actually, that's the arbitrage side, or special situations, buyouts, mergers. So there are various mutual funds that look to make money in special situations because of the general trend that the market may not continue on its uphill battle. Yes. Man, it's hot in here right now. I could feel it. Yes, sir.
You may not know this.
I may not.
Some retirees, when they retire, they go to live in other countries where the cost of living is low.
And continue receiving their pension.
Yeah. Now in the United States, you have the retirees get every year so-called cost of living adjustment, which is increased in their social security pension, which might be $20 or $30.
It all depends.
I'm not there. Do the people who live abroad, the retirees who live abroad, where in countries where the cost of living is low, like here, do they get the same cost of living increase that the retirees here get, or not?
I'd imagine a cost of living increase is a function of what the cost of living is for that particular country, so it's hard to say. I mean, inflation in the UK is 3%, and here we're flat. And I'd imagine their cost of living is going to be higher, but I don't know the answer to that. I'd imagine the answer is that every country has its own set of rules for increasing their pension, if at all. Yes, it's decided here, absolutely, because it's the United States government that's paying the Social Security.
I guess what you're trying to say, does it value if you go abroad?
Yes.
No, I'm saying if you go, let's say, to Mexico, to live there where the cost of living is lower than here, are you going to get the same money?
Oh, does Social Security look to see where you're living and adjust their No, the Social Security adjustment is a national figure, and it's not going to be based on where you are living. That's an interesting question. Yeah, like it's a lot cheaper to live in South Dakota than it is to live in Manhattan, and it increases as such, but they don't adjust that. I need to make a far differentiation. Well, to what extent there's reciprocity in that.
I
so.
Put that now developers are wanting to charge a fee, the land, and pass over that fee to homeowners. So if they sell a house that's worth $250,000, the homeowner's going to have to pay $5,000 or something to it. It's still in the talks, but they don't think it's going to go through. They're looking at different ways of earning money. They came out in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. I thought it was kind of interesting.
I'll have to take a look at that article. Yes.
Back to Social Security. Like, for instance, if someone retires in the States and they've been here for 34 years, what have you, and you do decide to move somewhere like Morocco, how does that work exactly? Is that not an appropriate question?
No, it's very appropriate.
Because after all of your investments are set and you retire and you formulate it whole in your life, are you still entitled to your Social Security?
Yes. You're entitled to Social Security if you worked here and you're eligible to receive Social Security. And if you're contributed into the system, then you're entitled to receive it regardless of where you live.
And also, I guess the second part to that question is, a lot of people happen to be just permanent residents as opposed to U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference there as well?
To the best of my knowledge, you don't have to be a citizen to be contributing and benefiting from the Social Security system. You can be a legal resident. But if you're someone who has worked outside the system your entire life and always worked in jobs that were cash jobs where you never contributed to the system, you're not going to retire with benefits.
Right. So say, for instance, anything before you became a legal resident, all of that is lost wages. You will never see...
I don't know if legal residency... No, legal resident is correct. Your legal residency is going to be the issue. Yes, absolutely. Because having a Social Security number is going to be the operative term.
I know many people who are not as fortunate to have all of their papers together and actually contributed to a Social Security number that wasn't theirs to begin
with,
but always contributed to that as well, or at least a good 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that, as I said, is just a loss. Even though
it's not totally lost, because... The Social Security system looks back on 40 quarters.
40 quarters?
Mm-hmm. So that's 10 years. So they have many years to make up for that.
Oh, okay. All right.
There you go. You're welcome. Yes, ma'am.
I'm operating on the assumption that when I retire, I won't receive Social Security.
Good thinking.
But retirement scares the crap out of me. I don't know how I can not outlive my income. You know, and currently, I was pretty aggressive with, you know, being in international funds and small caps, and I lost a ton of money. So now I'm confused. I don't know how to reassess my money.
If I may, I'm very happy that you asked that question. Remember I talked that our risk aversion is often impacted by our experience? Your experience of financial loss because you invested internationally or you invested in small companies does not make international investments or investments in small companies evil. It does not make it a bad investment decision. What you've experienced was a serious, serious financial setback, but you have the good fortune of having time on your side to have that eventually right itself. Without knowing your particular situation, I would advise you, without knowing, to save as much as and invest as much as you possibly can, because by the time that you retire, you'll have a substantial, substantial nest egg. And if you have an employer who matches a portion of your 401k contribution, that's a no-brainer. So I believe that investing in the U.S. is a very narrow way of looking at investments. Certainly, I recognize that it's a global world. well, it's always a global world, but it's a global economy. And though America's arms reach out to many countries, there are many other countries that are growing. Asia is a fine example. You look at the BRIC countries, for example, Brazil, Russia, India, China. These emerging markets are going to be ones who are going to be the future growers. Are they more volatile over the short term? Absolutely. Are they going to continue to grow over the long term? I certainly hope so. So I can't say absolutely because I don't have that crystal ball. So I would say maintain your long-term horizon, maintain a core allocation, and when you become panicked, don't move your core allocation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And remember that if you're investing on a consistent basis, if you're investing monthly, then as long as you continue doing that, when the markets turn against you, that same dollar amount is going to be buying you more. So when you look at your 401k and it's X minus 10%, you're now buying something cheaper. Yes, ma'am.
Do you think real estate is a good option for investing?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Do you think real estate is a good option?
I think real estate is always a very good option. It's just a function of what percent in your portfolio it's going to take. And how are we doing this? Are you buying a house? Because if you're buying a house, then if you're looking at it as an investment property, then recognize it's not liquid and it's not marketable. When nobody wants to buy it, nobody wants to buy it. It's not liquid. Why? Because you can't open up the newspaper and see how much your house on 63rd Road is selling for. So from that perspective, your real estate is neither marketable and it's not liquid, which makes it for a riskier investment. Over the long term, a tremendous amount of money has been made in real estate, in part because when real estate goes down, people don't immediately sell it. Your portfolio goes down, you're running for the hills, and you sell. So with real estate, over the long term, you have an asset, and over the long term, it's an appreciating asset. But we're in a deflationary environment right now, and we've gone through one of the largest real estate booms, and we're in a real estate decline. Over the long term, will it serve you well? Sure, provided that you don't overextend yourself. The mortgage company doesn't pad the numbers, and you certainly are in a position to afford it. The lack of liquidity and predictable in the market makes it a more risky investment. But over the long term, real estate is a fine diversion from other investments that you might have. Yeah?
What do you think about getting investment recommendations for mutual funds from financial magazines like Money, Keeping Your Smart Money? What is your opinion about that? How unbiased can it be?
I think that, how about I tell you a different story and you can draw your conclusion. When we create portfolios, you know, you have a portfolio and you've done your research and you've identified a few larger company stocks and you've identified a few small and you've diversified and you have the funds. How many mutual funds are out there in this world? 10,000? Okay. I bet you out of those 10,000, I bet you 200 are amazing. I don't need to own 200 funds. I'm really happy with my 5 or my 8 or my 10 or my 3. Money Magazine and Smart Money are in the business of what? Selling magazines. Exactly. And they accomplish selling magazines by writing articles about financial topics as opposed to writing, you know, about Britney Spears. So they're in the business of writing about financial instruments, mutual funds. They need to come out with a new magazine every month. You know what? The hot stock in January, the hot fund in January is not going to be the same one in July. Should you sell in July so that you can pick up the new one and get rid of the one in January? No. I think that their advice is sound. Excuse me. I think that their articles are sound, and I don't think they're meant to be misleading or self-serving. But recognize that there are many, many ideas and many ways to get to heaven. It doesn't mean you need to let go of your investment and your strategy. I have clients who come to me with portfolios, and I go, you know what? This, and this is great. This one, I don't know if it meets with your objective. You know, this one, you should get rid of this one because. So there's many ways to get there. There's not only one angle. But I think they do a fine job in educating the consumer, though there's no shortage of financial magazines. So, but Smart Money is one of the good ones. Yes. So this was kind of our upside down presentation. You know, we talked about distribution. We talked about a little bit of planning. We talked a bit about goal setting. And I may have bought in many things, but I tried to address as much as we, I guess, can take out of it being such a mixed bag. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have time to answer a question about dividend paying stock funds?
Sure.
That they're saying now maybe that's, you know, a good thing to do for retirement. But they're supposed to lose value a little less than the non-dividend paying stock funds.
Okay. A company that does not pay a dividend takes its excess earnings and reinvests it into itself by research, development, expansion, whatnot. So what that's telling us is that this is a growing company and they want to take that money to continue their growth. On the other hand, a company that is more mature in its growth stage says, we're generating this excess cash. Let's get a great tax deduction and let's reward our investors and let's pay out a dividend, which is a portion of their earnings. So dividend-paying companies are more mature, and if you're a more mature company, then it's likely that you are more stable. It's like me and my son. You know, I'm more mature and more stable. Now, taking that a step further, if you have a company that has a very high dividend, and I don't mean a dollar, but a high yield, it's paying 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12%, my first question is why? Because you do realize if the company is still paying $2 a share and they're down to $10 a share, they're not paying you 20% dividend. So maybe this company went from $50 a share down to $10. Why? So recognize that dividend paying is good. If the dividend is too high, then you really need to look to see why.
What could be one of the reasons why?
Stock price is greatly dropping, and it's dropping because there's either a fundamental issue with the company, or it could just be market reaction to market events.
So that means you could look for a moderate dividend compared to others in its class as a first step. And then look from the past and see if their stock price dropped a lot.
And then you can also just buy a growth and income fund.
Just forget about it, because they've done all that for you.
Exactly. And they've diversified for you.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to buy an individual stock for that.
Good. Good. Yeah, it's not wise to put all your eggs in one basket and say, wow, I wish I was right. Any other questions?
So you're saying if the stock price goes down for other reasons, somehow that's correlated to paying out a high dividend? No cause of effect?
No. I'm sorry if I misled you. Assuming that a company pays out a dividend, okay, so we have... It's a $20 per share, and it's paying you a dollar with your dividend. So that's 5%, right? I'm using quick numbers so I can do quick math, mind you. I'm not doing 86 and 3. Now you're getting 5%. Wow, you're feeling good. Stock goes up to $40 a share. Wow, you've had a huge appreciation. What are we getting now? Well, now we're getting a fraction of that 5%, right? So now you have a very low yield, because that same dollar divided by 40 is, you know, 0.25 whatnot, if I did my math. But on the flip side, if that $20 stock now becomes a $10 stock, gee, that same dollar, now you have a 10% dividend. And is it all that exciting? Because you've just lost 50% of your investment. So you have to recognize that the percentage of the dividend is called the yield. The dividend divided by the stock price is called the yield, and that yield is going to change with the stock price. So don't look at it in a vacuum. Look to see where it's been. Well, then I guess we can go home. All right? Thank you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.